I'm Kevin.
And I'm Stephanie.
And during our marriage, we have dealt with an electrocution, a brain tumor, brain surgery.
Then doctors telling us that children were not in our future, followed by miscarriage, and then Kevin's cancer diagnosis.
However, today, we live a life completely healed and restored with three healthy children who doctors said were not possible. And we're here to tell stories that inspire, give hope, and brighten your day. Welcome to
Tell Us a Good Story.
This episode is being presented to you by Storyside Church, where your story matters. At Storyside Church, they believe God always writes a good story.
You can join them for church online each Sunday morning on their Facebook page or watch their entire library of prior services on their YouTube channel, Storyside Church.
Steph, this next conversation is going to be amazing, and we're actually doing it in person.
Our first time ever. With like an actual guest, not like a friend.
Oh,
right?
Someone we haven't met before.
Yes.
That is true.
Mm-hmm.
That is true. Well, friends, our next guest is an international keynote speaker, best-selling author, and criminal justice professor. The new book that he co-authored with John Gordon is titled How to Be a Coffee Bean, 111 Life-Changing Ways to Create Positive Change. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Tell Us a Good Story, Mr. Damon West.
Hey, what's going on, y'all? It's great to be here. Thank you for the round of applause. This is great. It is great to be in person. This is like a total God thing because we just talked for the first time 2 weeks ago.
I think so, yeah.
And you said you were in Ohio. I said, hey, I've got Columbus, Ohio on my presentation list. And you're like, we're in Columbus.
Yes, because you spoke at Wendy's today.
I did.
So you're in Columbus.
Yeah.
So that's absolutely fantastic. And you said you didn't have any Frosties while you're there, which I'm impressed with.
I do not eat any Frosties. I love Frosties. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not anti-Frosty.
Right.
You're not, you know, I'm not like, I didn't cancel the Frosty. If I were to pick a sweet to eat, it would be carrot cake. I think about it like this. Like, so God gave me carrot cake as kryptonite, right? Which is not bad because most places don't carry carrot cake.
They don't. No.
I think I know a place that has carrot cake.
Stop it. Where?
I'll hook you up. I'll let you know.
You'll have to let me know after this.
You
see,
I will.
You see how like this, it's almost like addict behavior. We're going to talk about addict behavior today, but I just threw my addiction out there. It's not. It's a healthy one today. It's carrot cake. It's not like meth, but I threw it out there and just hoping someone would say, oh, I know where some carrot cake is, and it worked.
I got you. Done.
Well, Damon, first off, thank you for saying yes to us. So we were introduced to you by our mutual friend, Bob Bodine, and I went to Steph, and I was like, Steph, I just got off the phone with Damon West. You're going to love this guy. And she's like, okay, what's the story? And I was like, well, he served a few years in prison.
I was like, wait a second. Did he kill somebody? Yeah. How many people did he kill? Like, do we know how he killed them? Like, what's happening? Tell me everything.
Yeah. I'm like, well, I haven't got that far yet.
He's like, I don't think
but
that's
I
what
don't
it is.
I don't think that's why he served time.
No.
And then she's like, but we're meeting him in person and you didn't verify that yet? I'm like, yeah. Steph, I'm pretty sure we're fine here, right? Especially if Bob Bodine introduces
totally.
To him.
Right.
We're good. We're good. So,
look, and Steph, I get this. People are fascinated with prison, right? Because
100%.
It's a world you don't get to go see. There's only two ways to really go into a prison. You work there, you live there, you know? But my mom and my dad were waiting for me to pick me up. They came to see me in prison, by the way, over 150 times. They were waiting for me outside the gate November 16, 2015. And I swear to God, the first month I was home, my mom called me in the living room almost every night. Damon, come in here and watch this on TV. And she's watching Locked Up. And 60 days in. 60 days in. She loves prison shows.
Do you know this guy?
And she's like, Damon, this is the stuff you were talking about. I'm like, Mom, they're in a maximum security prison. That's what goes on. My dad, the first week I was home, my dad sits me down in the living room. He's like, Damon, watch all these prison movies with me. Tell me who got it right. So we're watching Cool Hand Luke. We're watching Shawshank Redemption.
Really?
Which, by the way, Shawshank got it right.
Really?
Yes. If anybody listening to this, if you're interested in prison culture, prison movies, whoever consulted on the movie Shawshank either had done time or worked in a prison for a long time because they got it right all the way down to the inmate culture, everything that goes on.
Okay, remind me, when we go to dinner later, I have stories. So we interviewed the director of Shawshank Prison, which is an hour north of here. So if you're ever back here in Columbus, Ohio, we will gladly take you there and go on a tour because that's where they filmed the movie Shawshank.
Incredible.
And it was actually a real life prison at some point and then closed and they made the movie there. But I've got some stories for you after
Let
this.
Let me ask y'all something about Shawshank. This will roll perfectly into the podcast. When y'all watch the movie Shawshank,
yes,
and you hear that, you see it, it's 2.5 hours. It's Morgan Freeman's character, Red, narrating the story. And he's talking about Andy, Tim Robbins' character. So when you watch Shawshank, what's the story about? Who's the story about, do you
hope.
Think? The story's about hope, but who's the story about?
Well, I thought it was about Tim Robbins, but I think it ended up being about Morgan Freeman, didn't it?
So that's where I was getting to on this. Like, when I watched it, my dad sits me down. I had seen Shawshank back in the 90s when it came out. But, I mean, in the 90s, I'm in my early 20s at best, living my best life in college, partying as a fraternity guy, college football player. My real-world life hasn't even started yet because I'm not a great guy back in college, by the way. Anybody who's listened to this and went to college with me, I was arrogant. I was cocky. But watching Shawshank back then, I couldn't grasp what the movie was about, this hope thing you're talking about. But after I got out of prison and watched it with my dad, I watched it and I realized this story is Red's story. It's Morgan Freeman's story. It happens to be that he's telling the story about the guy that saved his life. Because he's telling the story about this guy named Andy Dufresne who comes into this prison
right.
and changes everything in that prison. Andy Dufresne brought hope to the hopeless, right? And Red is dead. Red's a dead man. He's starting the story off. He's a dead man walking. There's a lot of dead people we see walking around. They're dead behind the eyes because they've lost hope. But what does Andy tell Red? Get busy living or get busy dying. Red is telling the story about the guy that saved his life because he restored hope. And that's one of the things I get to do in my new life. I get to restore hope. And the hopeless. And whenever I get to go into a prison, like the guys I was in prison with yesterday with Dak Prescott in that Texas prison, I told them, you know, you see people come into prisons all the time. They want to smuggle all kinds of different stuff in. You hear about it. You hear about they smuggle cell phones. They smuggle dope. They smuggle weapons in. I smuggle hope.
So let's step back a sec. Give context here. I want to go back to, let's say, college, right? Because you were a big-time athlete. You're in Texas. High school football star, right? You're a quarterback. You get a Division I scholarship to North Texas University, starting quarterback. What happens there that takes you down a different path?
Yeah, and that's a good term for it. It's a fork in the road. September 21st, 96, we're playing against Texas A&M. I'm 20 years old. I'm a starting quarterback for a Division I team in America. Third game of the season, third play of this game, we're driving down the field against the Aggies. I go down, suffer a career-ending injury, and I never played college football again. And I get up to this fork in the road in life, and football is gone. But more than just football was gone that day, my identity was gone with it. See, I wrapped my identity up into something external. Yeah. And you can't do that in life. Your identity, it cannot be something you're attached to because that's not you. It has to be something from within because anything you're attached to can be removed from you. And when football was gone, I made a lot of wrong turns. I couldn't deal with life on life's terms, so I got into more hardcore drugs. Before the injury, you know, I would drink beer, smoke pot. But after the injury, I got into drugs like cocaine, ecstasy pills, because I couldn't live with life on life's terms, so I put chemicals in to change the way I felt, to alter my way of living.
What was your injury?
I separated my shoulder, third-degree separation of my shoulder. I got to come back in the offseason and start competing for my job again, but in the offseason, I severed my Achilles tendon in half.
Oh, no.
When that happened, it was over. So, I mean, that game against A&M, last game I ever played. Didn't know it was going to be the last game I ever played. But the Achilles tendon thing was too hard to come back from. That was a devastating injury. But,
I believe it.
Yeah.
So how did you get introduced to cocaine or meth?
Or ecstasy? Yeah.
Is it the circle of friends that you were hanging out with? How do you get introduced to that for the first time?
Yeah. So there were guys I knew that did that stuff. They were in the fraternity. They played sports with me. Guys on campus. Yeah, but it was a world I didn't get into, the cocaine and stuff like that, because I was so busy in football. You know,
right.
I was so determined to be, and I'm an underdog, man. I'm an undersized quarterback. I'm 5'10", 165 pounds. Back then, no one wanted short quarterbacks. I had this giant chip on my shoulder, which a chip on your shoulder can be a good thing, too. It can be the thing that motivates you every day. But this giant chip on my shoulder was to work harder than anybody else to get where I wanted to go. So when I had football to focus on, my energy was there. I didn't have time to go party and do cocaine. I would go drink some beers and do that. I would smoke some pot. But I'm not getting off of the hardcore stuff. I don't have a reason to. But when I lost football, all my reason for living was gone. And instead of falling back on the things like the way I was raised in a home where Christ was at the center of everything, that's gone too. I've lost that along the way.
So is it one of those situations where once you take one of the hardcore drugs, is it immediately you're hooked?
It wasn't like that for me until meth, which comes later in the story. Yeah, meth was one of those drugs. It's like touching a live wire. I was instantly hooked with methamphetamine. I mean, just like that, instantly hooked. But it's made in a lab. It's made to get you hooked.
And okay.
I, when I smoked meth one time and I was instantly hooked. Now, the cocaine and stuff like that, yeah, I mean, I like the feeling of it. I didn't get hooked immediately. I was hooked eventually. But in my addiction, I mean, I'll do things. Addicts give up their goals to meet their behaviors. Mm. Addicts give up goals to meet behaviors. That's what addiction is. Focused people, driven and successful people, they give up behaviors to meet goals, but not an addict. Now, look, I'm not just talking about drug and alcohol addicts here. I'm talking about any kind of addict. Food, money, clothing, shopping, the internet, Instagram, social media. Anything that you can be addicted to that takes you away from the most important things in life, you can be an addict to that too. And you'll give up your goals to meet your behaviors.
So did you sell then?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, in order to get my drugs for free, I would sell drugs too. I mean, that's most drug users end up being drug dealers too. But I mean, I'm not the kind of drug dealer that, I'm not Scarface. I'm not sitting with, you know, in a nice house or anything like that. I sold enough to be able to pay for my own. And mm-hmm. that's generally how, you know, it was in college and right for college, you know. You four or five buddies want to go in and get some coke, and hey, I'll go put it together. I'll put the deal together, and you know, you tell everybody a little bit higher number on what it's going to cost, and yours is paid for too.
Kevin, did you know the two things I love to do is eat and support small businesses?
That is correct.
And Snacks with a Twist checks both boxes.
From specialty pretzels to sweet treats like peanut butter bark and our kids' favorite Buckeye and Marshmallow Pops, this store is a one-stop shop for snacks, treats, and gifts.
You guys will not be disappointed with anything you purchase, and they will ship it to your doorstep. They are a proud sponsor of Tell Us a Good Story.
So here's what is very interesting, because Steph, we watch Home Alone, and the two burglars in there were, what, the Wet Bandits or something?
Yes.
Damon ends up going on kind of a burglar spree, right? Mm-hmm. To the point where he was given a nickname.
Wait, wait. You robbed houses?
Yeah, what robbed?
Wait, why are you so excited about that?
I don't know.
So here's where, like, definitions matter. Robbing someone in the state of Texas where you have a weapon or you the fear of a weapon is used, like, you put your finger in your jacket and raise it like you got a gun, that would be a robbery because it looks like you have a weapon. A burglary is when you go into someone's house without their permission and you take things.
That's okay. Yes. Okay.
So did I break into people's houses? Absolutely. I have a lot of victims out there. I mean, look. My victims, the people whose homes I broke into, I didn't just steal their property. I stole their sense of security. And I don't even know if they're going to get that back. You know,
right.
They'll live with that for the rest
Fear.
Of their lives. Oh, man. Who knows the amount of damage I did to my victims? And there's a subset of people that I negatively impacted to a very high degree. And I don't know if they ever recovered from that. But in my life as a burglar, I use I statements here because I own my behaviors. That's part of like living a life that's real. I broke into people's homes and didn't just steal their property. I stole their sense of security. But we broke into so many homes. I broke into so many homes over this crime spree for 3 years. And it started in the uptown neighborhood of Dallas where I was once living when I was a stockbroker in Dallas. But they called these burglaries the uptown burglaries.
Okay.
And I was known as the uptown burglar. So you get one of those crime sprees where you get a name attached to it. So,
oh my gosh, I have so many things to talk to you about right now. Okay, so you're a stockbroker. You do these burglaries. Monday morning, you're there, you know, doing the job. Are you reading about?
Oh, no. This didn't go on. So what happened was I was a broker, partying all the time, up all night, passed out of sleep at work one day. This other stockbroker, this is in 2004. Other stockbroker comes up, he sees me sleeping, he wakes me up. He's like, Damon, you can't sleep on a job like this. The markets are open.
Right.
You're messing with people's money. They'll fire you. Come on down to the parking garage. I got something that'll pick you up. So I go with this guy to the parking garage that day. We get into his nice little sports car. He hands me this glass pipe. Crystal rocks in it.
I've
never seen a glass
no.
pipe before. So I'm like, man, what is that? He's like, just relax. He said, it's crystal meth. He said, you're going to love this stuff. And y'all, truer words have never been spoken. I fell in love with crystal meth that day. It's the most evil, most destructive, most addictive drug. One time, instantly hooked. And I started giving everything away for that drug. And then eventually I gave up my job. Then it was my home. Then it was my car. They repossessed that. I went from working on Wall Street to living on the streets of Dallas within 18 months. I was homeless. Yeah.
No.
Oh, I've slept in abandoned buildings. I've slept on park benches. I've done all that stuff. That is when I became a criminal. Because once the money was gone, the savings was gone, I had to fund my addiction somehow. I've lost everything, but I've gained this craving addiction for methamphetamines, and I follow in with a bunch of other meth addicts, and we are thieves. Theft and meth go together like rats and trash. Take that to the bank.
Really?
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
You're going
to
be stealing.
Well, you can't hold down a job. You're incapable of doing that. And then you've got to fund your addiction somehow, and you resort to crime. So many people that are locked up in the prison system in America are in there because of drugs. Now, they got a burglary charge, theft charge, whatever, but it goes back to a lot of drugs. You know, female prisoners. You look at a lot of female prisoners that go in for prostitution. Go poll people that have been to prison for prostitution. Most of that was around drugs. Drugs. When I was in prison, I was a sober observer to what was going on around me. I'd gotten a bachelor's degree back in 1999 from University of North Texas in sociology. So when I get to prison, I'm a sober observer to what's going on. Prison was like a giant sociological experiment that I was in. Because anything can happen inside this place. And it's a world of upside down rules, because in prison, people can do whatever they want to do. The only rules that can stop you are rules that are established inside the prison. And every pod that you live on is different. It got different rules because there's a different hierarchy of who's in charge.
Every prison would be different.
Yeah, every prison, every pod, even on the same prison. I mean, like, it depends on what gang runs that one pod, right? Who's in control of that pod? What's allowed to go on? It's a world where the strong survive. And if you're perceived to be weak, and weak would be someone that will not defend themselves, they won't fight back. They're devoured, man. I saw human beings devoured inside that place. Stuff you can't unsee.
So that was one thing I was thinking. Day one, you enter prison.
Mm-hmm.
What is that like? Are gangs just constantly trying to recruit you? Are you having to make a ton of decisions? Is it, I literally have to fight?
Yeah, and I knew what was going to happen because this old guy in Dallas County Jail, the guy that shares the story of the coffee bean with me, we'll go on that little bit. But he told me what the first day of prison was going to look like. He said, and he was telling me, he's an old black man. He's telling me, man, everything in prison is about race. Race runs the whole institution. The inmates want it to be that way. And that's what I'm saying. The rules of prison, the inmates decide the rules. Everybody in prison wants it to be about race because they want you to separate by your own race. Because if you hang out with your own race and your own kind, there's no chance for a racial war to break out if one person's just running astray and somebody from a different race jumps on that person. You can't get into a fight with someone in prison of a different race because you could start a gang war in there because everybody's supposed to belong to their own race, right? But my parents have told me before I go to prison, you can't get into one of these gangs, the Aryan Brotherhood gangs, no gangs and no tattoos, what my mom said. She said, you come home as the man we raised or don't come back to us at all. I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I got to figure this out. So the old black man in Dallas County Jail, Mr. Jackson, he's telling me, what the first day is going to look like. He said, because you're white, you're going to be approached by a white guy first. He said, the first guy that's going to come up to you is not a threat. He's an information gatherer. He's a scout. He's going to ask you one relevant question for your heart check. The heart check is the first fight you get into. It's the fight where they check your heart to see if you're going to defend yourself when the pressure comes, because it's coming right away. First guy's going to come up. He's going to ask you one relevant question. What gang do you want to be a part of? He said, man, get him out of your face as fast as you can and get ready, because the second guy comes up to you, he's not coming to talk to you. He's an enforcer. He's going to come hurt you.
Really?
He said, when the second guy gets within range, put your fist in his mouth. He said, hit him as hard as you can. Don't even let him talk, because you know what's coming, right? So I know this is coming at me. First day I go into the maximum security level 5 prison. Level 5 is the highest security level there is in Texas. It's where lifers go. 432 people, everybody's got life. You have to stay on that building for 5 years before you can move to any other part of the prison. It is an island. The reason why they make you stay there for 5 years is they want you to get escaping off your mind. They want you to get acclimated to prison.
Okay.
You're not coming off the building. You're escape risk. So I walk into 7 building, and within 5 minutes, a little white guy comes up to me, a little bald-headed white dude, and I'm standing by the door because Jackson told me, don't run to your bunk. Put your bags down. Put your back against the wall and just let this happen. So I'm like, all right. So I do exactly what he says, and I wait. Within 5 minutes, a little bitty white guy comes up first, a little bald-headed white dude. He gets in my face. He says, hey, white boy. What gang do you want to be a part of? What family do you want to be a part of? They call gangs families. And I'm like, man, just get out of my face, little guy. I'm riding with God. Please just leave me alone. I'm here with God. He laughed at me. He said, man, God isn't here, dude. We kicked him out a long time ago. But we're here, and we're coming to get you. You better get ready. He goes up the stairwell on the right side. Coming on the third tier, biggest white dude I've ever seen. He points at me from the third tier, coming to get you. He's coming down the stairwell on the right side. I get a good look at this guy. This guy's like an ogre, man. He's huge, muscled up in veins, massive dude.
Like Brock Lesnar coming down the steps.
Bald head and a swastika tattooed all around the top of his skull. A swastika, two beady eyeballs and muscles are coming at me, man. And, man, I remember what Jackson said, and I reached up and hit this guy as hard as I hit him in the mouth with everything I had, y'all. And in 20 seconds, that fight was over because he beat me from one side of the day room to the other. My hit didn't faze him. I mean, it made him laugh.
Really?
Oh, man, I gave him everything I had. This guy beat me from one side of the day room to the other. Jackson told me, you don't have to win all your fights, but you do have to fight all your fights. That was the rule. He said, don't worry about going out and winning these fights. You're going to lose so many of these fights. Just show up and fight. This is the predatory environment thing I'm telling you about. If you don't defend yourself in a place like that, this fighting that I'm doing on day one, that's nothing compared to what's coming down the road for me.
It's going to be worse.
Because if you don't defend yourself, all the predators come out. Because this is someone that won't hurt them, that won't fight back, that won't give them a black eye, won't bust their lip. It's easy prey, and there's going to be guys that are like that. And these are the guys, you know, you see a guy that's been raped repeatedly, passed around and broken as a human being. Men are broken when that happens to them. Broken. They're just not the same person anymore. I didn't want to be one of those, you know? So Jackson's like, just defend yourself. Just go and fight. Don't worry about winning and losing. That's what I did, y'all. I just, for 2 weeks, I fought the white gangs. I mean, and lost most of my fights. After that, it was the black gangs. Because Jackson told me, you'll fight the whites first, then you fight the blacks, and then you'll earn the chance to walk alone. It took me almost 2 months of fighting. Constant
really?
Fight. Probably 36 fights in the first 2 months. Lost 75% of my fights.
Wait, where are the guards in this?
Yeah, I mean, here's the deal about fighting in prison. Like, it's prison. There's going to be fights. The guards know there's going to be fights. The inmates know there's going to be fights. Guards typically are like, hey, look, I got a job to do. My job is to make sure that y'all are doing the right thing when I'm around. You know, if I'm not around, I can't see what's going on. Wait till I get out of the pod. That's generally the mindset of the guards. Because the guards can't stop that from happening. It's prison. That's part of the prison culture. Mm-hmm. Violence is the glue that holds all of prison together. It's the threat of violence, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because the threat of violence says that if I touch another person, if I put my hands on somebody, if I bump into somebody, and I don't have respect enough to say, excuse me, or I'm sorry, or my bad, that can get me hurt. It can get me killed to do that. So the threat of violence has people doing the right thing. I talk about this in my book, The Change Agent. A thief in prison is a very rare thing to find. In fact, prison, if you've established yourself and you're not someone that can be pushed around, you've shown that you're going to defend yourself and defend your stuff, you could leave your property in the day room, which is the main area where everybody is. Everybody lives in their cells. You come out to the day room where the TVs are. I could leave stuff in the day room for days at a time. People did. They would leave stuff in the day room for days at a time, and no one will touch it. No one will. You leave something on the day room table, and no one will even touch it because you can't touch another man's property. That's disrespect. And if you've earned your right to exist in there, no one's going to touch it. It's one of the safest places there is for your stuff. It's way safer than out here.
When you were arrested and you're talking to Mr. Jackson and he's telling you this, how scared were you?
Mortified, terrified. And that's when he's like, hey, let me break it down for you a different way. And he said, I want you to imagine prison as a pot of boiling water. And he said, anything we put into this pot of boiling water is going to be changed by the heat and the pressure inside this pot. He said, I'm going to put three things in this pot of boiling water and watch how they change. A carrot, an egg, and a coffee bean. So here's where I first hear the story, the coffee bean. The summer of 2009 in Dallas County Jail, exactly 10 years before John Gordon and I write the best-selling book, The Coffee Bean, in the summer of 2019. And so he tells me, he's like, first things first. He said, if I put a carrot in the pot of boiling water we call prison, what happens to the carrot? I mean, the carrot's going to turn soft, you know? That's what happens to a carrot. He said, that's right. The carrot goes into water hard, but the water, the prison, it'll turn the hard carrot soft, mushy, weak. Carrot gets beat. He gets robbed. May get killed. You don't want to be the carrot. What about the egg? What happened to the egg in the pot of boiling water we call prison? I was like, well, the egg will turn hard, man, like a hard-boiled egg. He said, that's right. He said, the egg has a shell that protects it physically. But inside that shell, that soft liquid core, the egg's heart becomes hardened. He says, if your heart becomes hardened, you become incapable of giving or receiving love. And he said, if you're incapable of giving or receiving love, you become institutionalized and you won't come back as someone your parents recognize because your eggshell will have swastikas tattooed all over it.
Mm.
And then he asked me, he said, what about the coffee bean? What happened to the coffee bean in the pot of boiling water we call prison? And y'all, I didn't have an answer for Mr. Jackson. I didn't know what happened to a coffee bean in a pot of boiling water. And that is when Mr. Jackson, a man who looked nothing like me, didn't come from the same America I came from, didn't believe the same things I believed in life. This is a black Muslim man from the streets of Dallas, Texas. I'm a white, middle-class Catholic guy from a little bitty town called Port Arthur, Texas. But this man who was so different than me shared with me one of the most important and transformational messages I've ever received in my entire life. And if you close yourself off to people because of their differences, you're going to miss some of the most important lessons and some of the best friendships in this life. because Mr. Jackson shared with me that day. He said, if I put a coffee bean in the same pot of boiling water we call prison, he said, now you got to change the name of the water to coffee. Because he said the coffee bean, the smallest of the three things, he said, small like you, had the power to change the entire atmosphere inside that pot because the power was inside the coffee bean. He said, just like the power is inside of you.
It changed the atmosphere. It didn't change him.
Oh, my gosh.
This Mr. Jackson sounds like Morgan Freeman.
I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, is this Red? Are we talking about Red here?
What do you look like?
Yeah.
He was incredible.
I have a question for you because you said when you're doing the drugs, like you got away from God. Like God means nothing to you. But then you said when you were in prison, like, guys, it's me and God in here. So what changed?
Yeah. So my God became meth, you know, and that's what I think happens to people a lot of times. They worship, you know, when you're living a life that's not in the path of Christ or what you're supposed to be living, you're worshiping the wrong things. And this happens in life. It happens to a lot of people, man. And people that use, just because someone goes to church doesn't mean they're really, really living a good spiritual life. And in my book, The Change Agent, you know, I talk about the difference between religion and spirituality. There's a big difference between religion and spirituality. I mean, because I meet a lot of religious people. I've known a lot of religious people that weren't very spiritual. They didn't live a really good life because they weren't very spiritual. In prison, they say this, the difference between religion and spirituality. Religion is for people who have never been to hell and don't want to go. Spirituality is for people who've been to hell and don't want to go back. Life is tough. Life is hard.
Yes, it is.
But spirituality is the thing that holds us together from that. When you live in the, you know, what Christ wants you to live like. And whenever I got into prison, the activating event for this goes back to the day I was sentenced to life in prison, May 18th, 2009. So that night, when I get back to my pod, because I mean the trial has lasted 6 days, and these guys, it's high profile. Like you said, it's got a name to it. It's in the news. The Uptown Burglar sentenced to 65 years. When I walk into my pod in Dallas County Jail, everybody's looking at me like a dead man walking because I just got a life sentence handed to me. No one wants to come near you. It's like they can catch it, right? Like no one wants to catch this life sentence. Like, stay away from me, dude. And I know that all these eyes are on me. Here's the thing about prison and jail. You can't cry. You can't show emotion like that. That's weakness. That's what the predators are looking for, that. And like, I know, I'm consciously aware there's predators watching me to see how I'm handling this because like vultures, they see something dead. So I go gather my things, and I go take my shower. Hold my head up high, go take my shower. And the shower is where you can cry because you can't really tell someone's been crying in the shower. Your eyes are red, you know.
Right.
And I start crying, y'all. And I just have a conversation with Christ. I'm like, hey, I can't do this anymore. And y'all know this. It's, Christ is like, come on. I never left. I got you, you know. And that was when I surrendered.
If you like what you hear, please tell someone about us. As soon as this episode is over, go tell your spouse, your closest friend, a parent, a coworker, or share one of our posts on social media.
However, if you don't like what you're hearing, please do not.
Don't tell anybody.
Just disregard this message.
Don't worry about
it. Forget about us.
Yep.
Go on with your merry day.
And to get more information about us or our entire catalog of episodes, be sure to check us out at kevinandsteph.com. Thank you for listening to Tell Us a Good Story.
Can you share the story with Steph of how you were actually arrested?
Yeah, July 30th, 2008, because I'm sitting on the couch smoking meth with my meth dealer. His name is Tex. We're passing this pipe back and forth. It's at this apartment where I live. And I'm telling Tex, dude, you don't want to be here. The cops are closing in on me. The end is near. 10 days before this, they picked up my partner in crime, Dustin, in a stolen car. So they've got my partner in crime in custody, which means I know they're going to get to me because they're going to break him. Mm-hmm. And man, just as I'm passing the pipe back to Tex, the window on the right blows out and shatters. And then tumbling across the living room floor is a little canister going end over end, smoking on one side. And it's like slow motion. It's like, oh my God, this is going on. I've seen this movie before.
Right.
And I tried to get out of there as fast as I could, but man, that thing's on a fuse. It blows up in my face. The flashbang grenade, boom, blows me back on the couch. Bright white light, loud noise. And man, when I came to, when I could see and hear again, there's a cop standing over me in full SWAT riot gear, boot on my chest. The barrel of an assault rifle is digging my eye socket. I can feel the barrel pressing against my skull. And his fingers over that trigger, and he is screaming at the top of his lungs, don't move, don't move. And I'm like, man, don't worry. Don't worry. You know? And one of the cops comes in and screams out loud, we got him. We got the Uptown Burglar. That was it. And they had me.
Friends, thank you for listening to this episode of Tell Us a Good Story.
For additional content and longer episodes, you can go to our website at kevinandsteph.com or wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
And don't forget, you can catch us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 10 a.m. right here on the AM/FM 24/7 network. Thank you for listening to
Tell Us a Good Story.